This is disc number 2.
Barbara gravitated toward the study of child development, hoping somehow to sort things out for herself. As an undergraduate at the University of Guelph, her great mental disparities were again apparent. But fortunately, her teachers saw that she had a remarkable ability to pick up nonverbal cues in the Child Observation Laboratory, and she was asked to teach the course. She felt there must have been some mistake. Then she was accepted into graduate school at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education, OISE. Most students read a research paper once or twice, but typically Barbara had to read one 20 times as well as many of its sources to get even a fleeting sense of its meaning. She survived on 4 hours of sleep a night. Because Barbara was brilliant in so many ways and so adept at child observation, her teachers in graduate school had trouble believing she was disabled. It was Joshua Cohen, another gifted but learning disabled student at OISE, who first understood. He ran a small clinic for learning disabled kids that used the standard treatment, compensations, based on the accepted theory of the time. Once brain cells die or fail to develop, they cannot be restored. Compensations work around the problem. People with trouble reading listen to audio tapes. Those who are slow are given more time on tests. Those who have trouble following an argument are told to color code the main points. Joshua designed a compensation program for Barbara, but she found it too time-consuming. Moreover, her thesis, a study of learning disabled children treated with compensations at the OISE clinic, showed that most of them were not really improving, and she herself had so many deficits that it was sometimes hard to find healthy functions that could work around her deficits. Because she had had such success developing her memory, she told Joshua she thought there must be a better way. One day, Joshua suggested she look into some books by Alexander Luria that he had been reading. She tackled them, going over the difficult passages countless times, especially a section in Luria's Basic Problems of Neurolinguistics about people with strokes or wounds who had trouble with grammar, logic, and reading clocks. Luria, born in 1902, came of age in revolutionary Russia. He was deeply interested in psychoanalysis, corresponded with Freud, and wrote papers on the psychoanalytic technique of free association, in which patients say everything that comes to mind. His goal was to develop objective methods to assess Freudian ideas. While still in his 20s, he invented the prototype of the lie detector. When the great purges of the Stalin era began, psychoanalysis became scientia non grata, and Luria was denounced. He delivered a public recantation, admitting to having made certain ideological mistakes. Then, to remove himself from view, he went to medical school. But he had not totally finished with psychoanalysis. Without calling attention to his work, he integrated aspects of the psychoanalytic method and of psychology into neurology, becoming the founder of neuropsychology. His case histories, instead of being brief vignettes focused on symptoms, described his patients at length. As Oliver Sacks wrote, Luria's case histories, indeed, can only be compared to Freud's in their precision, their vitality, their wealth and depth of detail. One of Luria's books, The Man with a Shattered World, was a summary of and commentary on the diary of a patient with a very peculiar condition. At the end of May 1943, Comrade Lyova Zazetsky, a man who seemed like a boy, came to Luria's office in the rehabilitation hospital where he was working. Zazetsky was a young Russian lieutenant who had just been injured in the Battle of Smolensk, where poorly equipped Russians had been thrown against the invading Nazi war machine. He had sustained a bullet wound to the head with massive damage to the left side, deep inside his brain. For a long time he lay in a coma. When Zazetsky awoke, his symptoms were very odd. The shrapnel had lodged in the part of the brain that helped him understand relationships between symbols. He could no longer understand logic, cause and effect, or spatial relationships. He couldn't distinguish his left from his right. He couldn't understand the elements of grammar dealing with relationships. Prepositions such as in, out, before, after, with, and without had become meaningless to him. He couldn't comprehend a whole word, understand a whole sentence, or recall a complete memory, because doing any of those things would require relating symbols. He could grasp only fleeting fragments. Yet his frontal lobes, which allowed him to seek out what is relevant and to plan, strategize, form intentions, and pursue them, were spared. So he had the capacity to recognize his defects and the wish to overcome them. Though he could not read, which is largely a perceptual activity, he could write, because it is an intentional one. He began a fragmentary diary he called I'll Fight On that swelled to 3,000 pages. I was killed March 2, 1943, he wrote, but because of some vital power of my organism, I miraculously remained alive. Over 30 years, Luria observed him and reflected on the way Zazetsky's wound affected his mental activities. He would witness Zazetsky's relentless fight to live, not merely exist. Reading Zazetsky's diary, Barbara thought, he is describing my life. I knew what the words mother and daughter meant, but not the expression mother's daughter, Zazetsky wrote. The expressions mother's daughter and daughter's mother sounded just the same to me. I also had trouble with expressions like, is an elephant bigger than a fly? All I could figure out was that a fly was small and an elephant is big, but I didn't understand the words bigger and smaller. While watching a film, Zazetsky wrote, before I've had a chance to figure out what the actors are saying, a new scene begins. Luria began to make sense of the problem. Zazetsky's bullet had lodged in the left hemisphere at the junction of three major perceptual areas where the temporal lobe, which normally processes sound and language, the occipital lobe, which normally processes visual images, and the parietal lobe, which normally processes spatial relationships and integrates information from different senses, meet. At this junction, perceptual input from those three areas is brought together and associated. While Zazetsky could perceive properly, Luria realized he could not relate his different perceptions or parts of things to wholes. Most important, he had great difficulty relating a number of symbols to one another, as we normally do when we think with words. Thus, Zazetsky often spoke in malapropisms. It was as though he didn't have a large enough net to catch and hold words and their meanings, and he often could not relate words to their meanings or definitions. He lived with fragments and wrote, I'm in a fog all the time. All that flashes through my mind are images, hazy visions that suddenly appear and just as suddenly disappear. I simply can't understand or remember what these mean. For the first time, Barbara understood that her main brain deficit had an address. But Luria did not provide the one thing she needed, a treatment. When she realized how impaired she really was, she found herself more exhausted and depressed and thought she could not go on this way. On subway platforms, she looked for a spot from which to jump for maximum impact. It was at this point in her life, she was 28 and still in graduate school, that a paper came across her desk. Mark Rosenzweig of the University of California at Berkeley had studied rats in stimulating and non-stimulating environments, and in post-mortem exams he found that the brains of the stimulated rats had more neurotransmitters, were heavier, and had better blood supply than those from the less stimulating environments. He was one of the first scientists to demonstrate neuroplasticity by showing that activity could produce changes in the structure of the brain. For Barbara, lightning struck. Rosenzweig had shown that the brain could be modified. Though many doubted it, to her this meant that compensation might not be the only answer. Her own breakthrough would be to link Rosenzweig's and Luria's research. She isolated herself and began toiling to the point of exhaustion week after week, with only brief breaks for sleep at mental exercises she designed, though she had no guarantee they would lead anywhere. Instead of practicing compensation, she exercised her most weakened function, relating a number of symbols to each other. One exercise involved reading hundreds of cards picturing clock faces showing different times. She had Joshua Cohen write the correct time on the backs. She shuffled the cards so she couldn't memorize the answers. She turned up a card, attempted to tell the time, checked the answer, then moved on to the next card as fast as she could. When she couldn't get the time right, she'd spend hours with a real clock, turning the hand slowly, trying to understand why, at 2:45, the hour hand was 3/4 of the way toward the 3. When she finally started to get the answers, she added hands for seconds and 60ths of a second. At the end of many exhausting weeks, not only could she read clocks faster than normal people, but she noticed improvements in her other difficulties relating to symbols and began for the first time to grasp grammar, math, and logic. Most important, she could understand what people were saying as they said it. For the first time in her life, she began to live in real time. Spurred on by her initial success, she designed exercises for her other disabilities, her difficulties with space, her trouble with knowing where her limbs were, and her visual disabilities, and brought them up to average level. Barbara and Joshua Cohen married, and in 1980 they opened the Arrowsmith School in Toronto. They did research together, and Barbara continued to develop brain exercises and to run the school from day to day. Eventually they parted, and Joshua died in 2000. Because so few others knew about or accepted neuroplasticity or believed that the brain might be exercised as though it were a muscle, there was seldom any context in which to understand her work. She was viewed by some critics as making claims that learning disabilities were treatable that couldn't be substantiated. But far from being plagued by uncertainty, she continued to design exercises for the brain areas and functions most commonly weakened in those with learning disabilities. In these years before high-tech brain scans were available, she relied on Luria's work to understand which areas of the brain commonly processed which mental functions. Luria had formed his own map of the brain by working with patients like Zazetsky. He observed where a soldier's wound had occurred and related this location to the mental functions lost. Barbara found that learning disorders were often milder versions of the thinking deficit seen in Luria's patients. Applicants to the Arrowsmith School, children and adults alike, undergo up to 40 hours of assessments designed to determine precisely which brain functions are weak and whether they might be helped. Accepted students, many of whom were distracted in regular school, sit quietly working at their computers. Some, diagnosed with attention deficit as well as learning disorders, were on Ritalin when they entered the school. As their exercises progress, some can come off medication because their attention problems are secondary to their underlying learning disorders. At the school, children who, like Barbara, had been unable to read a clock now work at computer exercises, reading mind-numbingly complex 10-handed clocks, with hands not only for minutes, hours, and seconds, but also for other time divisions, such as days, months, years, in mere seconds. They sit quietly, with intense concentration, until they get enough answers right to progress to the next level. When they shriek out aloud, "Yes!" and their computer screen lights up to congratulate them. By the time they finish, they can read clocks far more complex than those any normal person can read. At other tables, children are studying Urdu and Persian letters to strengthen their visual memories. The shapes of these letters are unfamiliar, and the brain exercise requires the students to learn to recognize these alien shapes quickly. Other children, like little pirates, wear eye patches on their left eyes and diligently trace intricate lines, squiggles, and Chinese letters with pens. The eye patch forces visual input into the right eye, then to the side of the brain where they have a problem. These children are not simply learning to write better. Most of them come with three related problems: trouble speaking in a smooth, flowing way, writing neatly, and reading. Barbara, following Luria, believes that all three difficulties are caused by a weakness in the brain function that normally helps us to coordinate and string together a number of movements when we perform these tasks. When we speak, our brain converts a sequence of symbols, the letters and words of the thought, into a sequence of movements made by our tongue and lip muscles. Barbara believes, again following Luria, that the part of the brain that strings these movements together is the left premotor cortex of the brain. I referred several people with a weakness in this brain function to the school. One boy with this problem was always frustrated because his thoughts came faster than he could turn them into speech, and he would often leave out chunks of information, have trouble finding words, and ramble. He was a very social person, yet could not express himself and so remained silent much of the time. When he was asked a question in class, he often knew the answer, but took such a painfully long time to get it out that he appeared much less intelligent than he was, and he began to doubt himself. When we write a thought, our brain converts the words, which are symbols, into movements of the fingers and hands. The same boy had very jerky writing because his processing capacity for converting symbols into movements was easily overloaded. So he had to write with many separate small movements instead of long flowing ones. Even though he had been taught cursive writing, he preferred to print. As adults, people with this problem can often be identified because they prefer to print or type. When we print, we make each letter separately with just a few pen movements, which is less demanding on the brain. In cursive, we write several letters at a time, and the brain must process more complex movements. Writing was especially painful for the boy, since he often knew the right answers on tests, but wrote so slowly that he couldn't get them all down. Or he would think of one word, letter, or number, but write another. These children are often accused of being careless, but actually their overloaded brains fire the wrong motor movements. Students with this disability also have reading problems. Normally, when we read, the brain reads part of a sentence, then directs the eyes to move the right distance across the page to take in the next part of the sentence, requiring an ongoing sequence of precise eye movements. The boy's reading was very slow because he skipped words, lost his place, and then lost his concentration. Reading was overwhelming and exhausting. On exams, he would often misread the question, and when he tried to proofread his answers, he'd skip whole sections. At the Arrowsmith School, this boy's brain exercises involved tracing complex lines to stimulate his neurons in the weakened premotor area. Barbara has found that tracing exercises improve children in all three areas, speaking, writing, and reading. By the time the boy graduated, he read above grade level and could read for pleasure for the first time. He spoke more spontaneously in longer, fuller sentences, and his writing improved. At the school, some students listened to CDs and memorized poems to improve their weak auditory memories. Such children often forget instructions and are thought to be irresponsible or lazy, when in fact they have a brain difficulty. Whereas the average person can remember 7 unrelated items, such as a 7-digit phone number, these people can remember only 2 or 3. Some take notes compulsively, so they won't forget. In severe cases, they can't follow a song lyric from beginning to end, and they get so overloaded they just tune out. Some have difficulty remembering not only spoken language, but even their own thoughts, because thinking with language is slow. This deficit can be treated with exercises in rote memorizing. Barbara has also developed brain exercises for children who are socially clumsy, because they have a weakness in the brain function that would allow them to read nonverbal cues. Other exercises are for those who have frontal lobe deficits and who are impulsive or have problems planning, developing strategies, sorting out what is relevant, forming goals, and sticking to them. They often appear disorganized, flighty, and unable to learn from their mistakes. Barbara believes that many people labeled hysterical or antisocial have weaknesses in this area. The brain exercises are life-transforming. One American graduate told me that when he came to the school at 13, his math and reading skills were still at a third-grade level. He had been told after neuropsychological testing at Tufts University that he would never improve. His mother had tried him in 10 different schools for students with learning disabilities, but none had helped. After 3 years at Arrowsmith, he was reading and doing math at a 10th grade level. Now he has graduated from college and works in venture capital. Another student came to Arrowsmith at 16, reading at a first grade level. His parents, both teachers, had tried all the standard compensation techniques. After 14 months at Arrowsmith, he is reading at a 7th grade level. We all have some weak brain functions, and such neuroplasticity-based techniques have great potential to help almost everyone. Our weak spots can have a profound effect on our professional success, since most careers require the use of multiple brain functions. Barbara used brain exercises to rescue a talented artist who had a first-rate drawing ability and sense of color, but a weak ability to recognize the shape of objects. The ability to recognize shapes depends on a brain function quite different from those functions required for drawing or seeing color. It is the same skill that allows some people to excel at games like Where's Waldo. Women are often better at it than men, which is why men seem to have more difficulty finding things in the refrigerator. Barbara also helped a lawyer, a promising litigator who, because of a Broca's area pronunciation deficit, spoke poorly in court. Since expending the extra mental effort to support a weak area seems to divert resources from strong areas, a person with a Broca's problem may also find it harder to think while talking. After practicing brain exercises focused on Broca's area, the lawyer went on to a successful courtroom career. The Arrowsmith approach and the use of brain exercises generally has major implications for education. Clearly, many children would benefit from a brain area-based assessment to identify their weakened functions and a program to strengthen them, a far more productive approach than tutoring that simply repeats a lesson and leads to endless frustration. When weak links in the chain are strengthened, people gain access to skills whose development was formerly blocked, and they feel enormously liberated. A patient of mine, before he did the brain exercises, had a sense that he was very bright, but could not make full use of his intelligence. For a long time, I mistakenly thought his problems were based primarily on psychological conflicts, such as a fear of competition, and buried conflicts about surpassing his parents and siblings. Such conflicts did exist and did hold him back, but I came to see that his conflict about learning, his wish to avoid it, was based mostly on years of frustration and on a very legitimate fear of failure based on his brain's limits. Once he was liberated from his difficulties by Arrowsmith's exercises, his innate love of learning emerged full force. The irony of this new discovery is that for hundreds of years, educators did seem to sense that children's brains had to be built up through exercises of increasing difficulty that strengthened brain functions. Up through the 19th and early 20th centuries, a classical education often included rote memorization of long poems in foreign languages, which strengthened the auditory memory, hence thinking in language, and an almost fanatical attention to handwriting, which probably helped strengthen motor capacities and thus not only helped handwriting, but added speed and fluency to reading and speaking. Often a great deal of attention was paid to exact elocution and to perfecting the pronunciation of words. Then, in the 1960s, educators dropped such traditional exercises from the curriculum because they were too rigid, boring, and not relevant. But the loss of these drills has been costly. They may have been the only opportunity that many students had to systematically exercise the brain function that gives us fluency and grace with symbols. For the rest of us, their disappearance may have contributed to the general decline of eloquence, which requires memory and a level of auditory brain power unfamiliar to us now. In the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858, the debaters would comfortably speak for an hour or more without notes in extended, memorized paragraphs. Today, many of the most learned among us, raised in our most elite schools since the 1960s, prefer the omnipresent PowerPoint presentation, the ultimate compensation for a weak premotor cortex. Barbara Arrowsmith Young's work compels us to imagine how much good might be accomplished if every child had a brain-based assessment, and if problems were found, a tailor-made program created to strengthen essential areas in the early years when neuroplasticity is greatest. It is far better to nip brain problems in the bud than to allow the child to wire into his brain the idea that he is stupid, begin to hate school and learning, and stop work in the weakened area, losing whatever strength he may have. Younger children often progress more quickly through brain exercises than do adolescents, perhaps because in an immature brain the number of connections among neurons or synapses is 50% greater than in the adult brain. When we reach adolescence, a massive pruning back operation begins in the brain, and synaptic connections and neurons that have not been used extensively suddenly die off, a classic case of use it or lose it. It is probably best to strengthen weakened areas while all this extra cortical real estate is available. Still, brain-based assessments can be helpful all through school and even in college and university, when many students who did well in high school fail because their weak brain functions are overloaded by the increased demand. Even apart from these crises, every adult could benefit from a brain-based cognitive assessment, a cognitive fitness test, to help them better understand their own brain. It's been years since Mark Rosenzweig first did the rat experiments that inspired Barbara and showed her that enriched environments and stimulation lead the brain to grow. Over the years, his labs and others have shown that stimulating the brain makes it grow in almost every conceivable way. Animals raised in enriched environments, surrounded by other animals, objects to explore, toys to roll, ladders to climb, and running wheels, learn better than genetically identical animals that have been reared in impoverished environments. Acetylcholine, a brain chemical essential for learning, is higher in rats trained on difficult spatial problems than in rats trained on simpler problems. Mental training or life in enriched environments increases brain weight by 5% in the cerebral cortex of animals and up to 9% in areas that the training directly stimulates. Trained or stimulated neurons develop 25% more branches and increase their size, the number of connections per neuron, and their blood supply. These changes can occur late in life, though they do not develop as rapidly in older animals as in younger ones. Similar effects of training and enrichment on brain anatomy have been seen in all types of animals tested to date. For people, postmortem examinations have shown that education increases the number of branches among neurons. An increased number of branches drives the neurons farther apart, leading to an increase in the volume and thickness of the brain. The idea that the brain is like a muscle that grows with exercise is not just a metaphor. Some things can never be put together again. Lyova Zazetsky's diaries remained mostly a series of fragmented thoughts till the end. Alexander Luria, who figured out the meaning of those fragments, could not really help him. But Zazetsky's life story made it possible for Barbara Arrowsmith Young to heal herself and now others. Today, Barbara Arrowsmith Young is sharp and funny, with no noticeable bottlenecks in her mental processes. She flows from one activity to the next, from one child to the next, a master of many skills. She has shown that children with learning disabilities can often go beyond compensations and correct their underlying problem. Like all brain exercise programs, hers works best and most quickly for people with only a few areas of difficulty. But because she has developed exercises for so many brain dysfunctions, she is often able to help children with multiple learning disabilities, children like herself, before she built herself a better brain. Chapter 3. Redesigning the Brain. A scientist changes brains to sharpen perception and memory, increase speed of thought, and heal learning problems. Michael Merzenich is a driving force behind scores of neuroplastic innovations and practical inventions, and I am on the road to Santa Rosa, California to find him. His is the name most frequently praised by other neuroplasticians, and he's by far the hardest to track down. Only when I found out that he would be at a conference in Texas, went there, and sat myself down beside him, was I finally able to set up a meeting in San Francisco. "Use this email address," he says. "And if you don't respond again, be persistent." At the last minute, he switches our meeting to his villa in Santa Rosa. Merzenich is worth the search. The Irish neuroscientist Ian Robertson has described him as the world's leading researcher on brain plasticity. Merzenich's specialty is improving people's ability to think and perceive by redesigning the brain by training specific processing areas, called brain maps, so that they do more mental work. He has also, perhaps more than any other scientist, shown in rich scientific detail how our brain processing areas change. This villa in the Santa Rosa Hills is where Merzenich slows down and regenerates himself. This air, these trees, these vineyards seem like a piece of Tuscany transplanted into North America. I spend the night here with him and his family, and then in the morning we are off to his lab in San Francisco. Those who work with him call him MERS, to rhyme with whirs and stirs. As he drives his small convertible to meetings, he's been double-booked much of the afternoon, his gray hair flies in the wind, and he tells me that many of his most vivid memories in this, the second half of his life, he's 61, are of conversations about scientific ideas. I hear him pour them into a cell phone in his crackling voice. As we pass over one of San Francisco's glorious bridges, he pays a toll he doesn't have to because he's so involved with the concepts we are discussing. He has dozens of collaborations and experiments all going on at once and has started several companies. He describes himself as just this side of crazy. He is not, but he is an interesting mix of intensity and informality. He was born in Lebanon, Oregon, of German stock, and though his name is Teutonic and his work ethic unrelenting, his speech is West Coast, easygoing, down to earth. Of neuroplasticians with solid, hard science credentials, it is Mrzenek who has made the most ambitious claims for the field, that brain exercises may be as useful as drugs to treat diseases as severe as schizophrenia, that plasticity exists from the cradle to the grave, and that radical improvements in cognitive functioning, how we learn, think, perceive, and remember, are possible even in the elderly. His latest patents are for techniques that show promise in allowing adults to learn language skills without effortful memorization. Mrzenek argues that practicing a new skill under the right conditions can change hundreds of millions and possibly billions of the connections between the nerve cells in our brain maps. If you're skeptical of such spectacular claims, keep in mind that they come from a man who has already helped cure some disorders that were once thought intractable. Early in his career, Mrzenek developed, along with his group, the most commonly used design for the cochlear implant, which allows congenitally deaf children to hear. His current plasticity work helps learning disabled students improve their cognition and perception. These techniques, his series of plasticity-based computer programs, Fast Forward, have already helped hundreds of thousands. Fast Forward is disguised as a children's game. What is amazing about it is how quickly the change occurs. In some cases, people who have had a lifetime of cognitive difficulties get better after only 30 to 60 hours of treatment. Unexpectedly, the program has also helped a number of autistic children. Mrzenek claims that when learning occurs in a way consistent with the laws that govern brain plasticity, the mental machinery of the brain can be improved so that we learn and perceive with greater precision, speed, and retention. Clearly, when we learn, we increase what we know, but Mrzenek's claim is that we can also change the very structure of the brain itself and increase its capacity to learn. Unlike a computer, the brain is constantly adapting itself. The cerebral cortex, he says of the thin outer layer of the brain, is actually selectively refining its processing capacities to fit each task at hand. It doesn't simply learn. It is always learning how to learn. The brain, Mrzenek describes, is not an inanimate vessel that we fill. Rather, it is more like a living creature with an appetite, one that can grow and change itself with proper nourishment and exercise. Before Mrzenek's work, the brain was seen as a complex machine, having unalterable limits on memory, processing speed, and intelligence. Mrzenek has shown that each of these assumptions is wrong. Mrzenek did not set out to understand how the brain changes. He only stumbled on the realization that the brain could reorganize its maps. And though he was not the first scientist to demonstrate neuroplasticity, it was through experiments he conducted early in his career that mainstream neuroscientists came to accept the plasticity of the brain. To understand how brain maps can be changed, we need first to have a picture of them. They were first made vivid in human beings by the neurosurgeon Dr. Wilder Penfield at the Montreal Neurological Institute in the 1930s. For Penfield, mapping a patient's brain meant finding where in the brain different parts of the body were represented and their activities processed, a solid localizationist project. Localizationists had discovered that the frontal lobes were the seat of the brain's motor system, which initiates and coordinates the movement of our muscles. The three lobes behind the frontal lobe, the temporal, parietal, and occipital lobes comprise the brain's sensory system, processing the signal sent to the brain from our sense receptors, eyes, ears, touch receptors, and so on. Penfield spent years mapping the sensory and motor parts of the brain while performing brain surgery on cancer and epilepsy patients who could be conscious during the operation because there are no pain receptors in the brain. Both the sensory and motor maps are part of the cerebral cortex, which lies on the brain surface and so is easily accessible with a probe. Penfield discovered that when he touched a patient's sensory brain map with an electric probe, it triggered sensations that the patient felt in his body. He used the electric probe to help him distinguish the healthy tissue he wanted to preserve from the unhealthy tumors or pathological tissue he needed to remove. Normally, when one's hand is touched, an electrical signal passes to the spinal cord and up to the brain, where it turns on cells in the map that makes the hand feel touched. Penfield found he could also make the patient feel his hand was touched by turning on the hand area of the brain map electrically. When he stimulated another part of the map, the patient might feel his arm being touched, another part, his face. Each time he stimulated an area, he asked his patients what they'd felt to make sure he didn't cut away healthy tissue. After many such operations, he was able to show where on the brain's sensory map all parts of the body's surface were represented. He did the same for the motor map, the part of the brain that controls movement.